going on
far too long.
Tell you it's going on
far too long.
Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's going on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore. Yeah, somebody's hurting my sister, and it's gone.
That is Yara Allen, and she is a musicologist with the Poor People's Campaign, and she starts off with a sentiment we'll be carrying forward in this next segment. My name is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice. We're here with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1, and I have on the line with me here at KZFR Community Radio, Reverend Pamela Anderson. She's a Presbyterian church minister and has served multiple churches in California, New Jersey, and Australia. She has been an international speaker, professor of religion, coordinator of clergy conferences, an activist, and a community organizer. Dr. Anderson became involved with Poor People's Campaign in 2017 with the relaunching of the campaign and the 40 Days of Action. Welcome to Peace and Justice, Reverend Pamela Anderson. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're with us. And I wanted to start off with just a question, since you are a woman and you identify with women, and this is Women's History Month, and you're my first guest of the month. I'd like you to reflect on the history of a woman who helped create you or was a role model to you or whose ideals that you would emulate and follow if you were able.
Well, again, thank you for having me here, and I'm just so excited to be with you. And I would say a woman that has really influenced me is the woman that you just heard singing. And that is Yara Allen. And Yara Allen is one of the main leaders of the Poor People's Campaign. She's a musicologist, and her voice just resonates, you know, when we are out there marching, when we are out there doing direct action, when we are, you know, out there putting our bodies on the line to risk arrest. There is a strength and a power when you have someone singing you along, encouraging you, preaching to you, essentially through voice, through singing. And this weekend is the anniversary of the Bloody Sunday, of the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, when Dr. King and, you know, the remembrance of all those who walked across it. But before that was John Lewis and his activists, and they were beaten and bloodied, and they're going back this weekend. It all begins tonight, actually. So my heart's in Selma, Alabama, as folks are going to be crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge again today, and Yara's voice is going to be singing. You'll hear her voice singing, and I'm just waiting to hear it, you know, her, across the wind, that her sweet music as it comes to California. But she is someone that is just powerful, and I just so appreciate her leadership and the impact that she has had on me. And just as a quick note about that song, you know, it was that song, Somebody's Hurting My Brother, you know, Somebody's Been Hurting My Sister, and it's gone on far too long. We won't be silent anymore. It came out of a town hall meeting about coal ash with Duke Energy because they were spilling ash into poor black and brown and white neighborhoods. And after testimony after testimony impacted people physically and mentally about the coal ash, this song became the inspiration. And her voice is powerful when she sings that. So Yara Allen is someone who has deeply influenced me.
Oh, that's a wonderful introduction. And I was lucky enough to hear that whole song, and I'm sorry to our listeners that I potted it down so we could start the interview. But yes, she has an incredibly powerful voice, and I can hear it ringing from Selma now. So let's all tune our ears to Selma this year.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. You know, Dr. Pamela Anderson, I didn't complete your introduction because I was sort of wanted to break it up and I wanted to tell our listeners a little more about you. Along with Linda Liang, Dr. Anderson has been selected as one of the organizers for the state of California to help the Poor People's Campaign mobilize for the March on Washington, June 18th. When asked about being selected for the position, Dr. Anderson said, "I'm so humbled to be part of this community and to collectively work together to continue the work that Dr. King began with his colleagues in 1967. I'm so inspired by this campaign with the leadership of Bishop Barber and Reverend Dr. Liz Theoharis. It is a fusion movement of radical inclusion where nobody is out and everybody is in. As one of the Poor People's Campaign principles states, this is not about left and right, Democrat or Republican, but about right and wrong. When 140 million people living in America today are poor or low income in the richest nation in the world, there is something morally wrong and we must speak up. We say, as we say in the campaign, when we lift from the bottom, everybody rises." Such a wonderful thing compared to trickle down. So I wanted to ask you some more about this. You talked about the principles, and the Poor People's Campaign is based on a moral agenda that's grounded on fundamental rights. Can you talk about some of the key themes of that agenda?
Sure. So there's five pillars to this campaign, and they are interlocking injustices. So one is poverty. So here, for instance, I'll just say all of them, and then I'll go back and just, give points to them. It is systemic poverty, ending systemic racism, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the distorted national religious narrative. So when it comes to poverty, for instance, here in California, we are the fifth largest economy in the world. California's economy is $3.35 trillion. We surpass the United Kingdom, and they are at $2.76 trillion. So if we are the fifth largest economy in the world, and we are the most populous state in the United States, yet we have a 51% poverty rate, and 63% of them are children. There's just something morally wrong about that. And we need to speak up. And like the song says, we won't be silent anymore. So there's something that needs to be done about that. In the United States, as you know, I said in my statement, there are 140 million people here in the United States that are either poor or low income, or just one paycheck away from a disaster. And if we are not addressing this need, there's something that's just morally wrong. There's enough. There is enough here in the United States. There's just a lack of moral will to make change. So that's one about poverty, systemic racism. It is people in in the a black person is 9 times more likely to be arrested compared to a white person. Here with the statistics that we have, we also have with systemic racism that before the pandemic began, there were 131,000 people imprisoned here in California, and 79% of them are people of color. There's just something that, again, that's morally wrong about that. With our war economy, there is 59 cents to the tax dollar that goes towards militarism, and only less than 3 cents that goes to health and education and support of our children. When we talk about the ecological devastation, you're based in Chico, I understand. And
that's right.
Look what happened with the campfire. We have, global warming. We have these fires that have come through due to the changing climate change. And now suddenly, thousands of people have been displaced and made homeless because of the fires that swept through. So these are interlocking injustices. And then also, if we just think about Flint, Michigan, in Flint, Michigan, to this day, because of all the chemical spills of lead in the water, that happened years ago. And to this day, in Flint, Michigan, you can buy unleaded gas, you can buy unleaded paint, but you cannot have unleaded water. And then when it comes to the distorted moral narrative, it's what's happening also in the Ukraine. Here we have people who are being made pawns in the geopolitical government, the bigger picture, and it's people who are poor, who are displaced, who are now pawns on the greater global scene. So there is something that we need to do to take a stand, to stand up, and to say this is not right, and we're not going to be silent anymore. So my apologies for giving that big overlay of information, but that's those are the pillars of the campaign.
And I think that's important, too. Reverend Pamela Anderson is our guest today, this morning on the Peace and Justice Program, and I want to learn more about the Poor People's Campaign. I understand that it's 45 state coordinating committees and a network of more than 250 labor and organizational partners and hundreds of faith partners and dozens of national faith bodies. And yet, we don't hear about it enough. Can you tell us a little bit about more about the Poor People's Campaign itself?
Yes, I would love to tell you all about it. So it's very exciting. One of the things that I am doing as the state organizer, as one of the organizers for the State of California, we are mobilizing for June 18th. We're going to be doing a moral march on Washington, D.C., and everyone is invited. So if you are listening, I want to say, you get an invitation, you get an invitation, you get an invitation. We're all going to Washington, D.C., so make your way there. There's going to be a big moral march. It begins at 10 a.m. in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be an all-day event. So what we're doing is we're mobilizing about poor and low-wage workers to be able to have their voices heard and people of impact. And so that's one of the things that's happening. And also, please email me if you want to get in contact with me, if you want to send a delegation, or if you have a group, or you have a faith group, or some more folks that you want to have more conversations with, you can email me at mobilizecalifornia@gmail.com. Again, mobilizecalifornia@gmail.com. You can also go right now to www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. And that will give you all the information you need to know. You can sign up right there. And so we have some upcoming events here in California. We're on March 13. If you would like to be on a Zoom call where Bishop Barber himself and Reverend Dr. Liz Theo-Harris, they're going to be on that Zoom call. That is happening on March 13 at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and we will also give you more information about our mobilization for June 18 in Washington, D.C. But again, if you want to be on that convening call, just send me an email, mobilizecalifornia@gmail.com. I'm happy to send you those links. And then also, we have the Beyond Vietnam public readings that are going to be happening. And if that's something that you would like to organize, we're going to be reading Dr. King's speech on April 4th, 1967. Chris, you may not know this, but Dr. King gave his Beyond Vietnam speech, and a year later, to the day, that's when he was murdered. So we're going to be remembering him and his work and, you know, saying an end to war. You know, it's just, that's going to be a reading that's going to be happening on that day. And then, also, it gets even better, Chris. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
You're ready? Here we go. May 16 in Los Angeles. This is the only Western tour that Bishop Barber and Liz Thayer Harris are going to be doing, and it's going to be in Los Angeles on Monday, May 16, from 4 to 6 p.m. So if you are not able, for whatever reason, to get to Washington, D.C., we at least want you to get to Los Angeles for the mobilization tour, because we believe that the more people we can get to L.A., the more people we will get to Washington, D.C., but it is going to be so good, and we're organizing buses at the buses. You can go to rally.co so that you can be able to find out more information if there's going to be a bus that's going to be closer to your place to get you down there. But that is something that we are organizing. So if you would like to send a delegation or be a bus captain or just want to know more information, again, just email me at mobilizecalifornia@gmail.com. It's so exciting. This work, it's so amazing and so powerful and so needed in our country at this time, especially with this great divide. And in the introduction, again, this is not about left or right or red or blue or Democrat or Republican. This is about right and wrong. And this is what we are... Why we do this work, because somebody is hurting our people, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore.
Yeah, and I hear that. And in terms of people who are local who may not be able to make it to either of these, they could do the Zoom call, and in
right.
order to do that, they just need to write to you, mobilizecalifornia@gmail, in order to get the link. But in terms of their participation, or do you need financial help to rent these buses and to get affected people there? It seems like you want low-income people there. Yeah,
absolutely. So if you cannot get there yourself, but you would like to help an impacted person to get there for their voice to be heard, there again, email me and I can send you links on how you can donate to the Poor People's Campaign. But also, if you go to www.poorpeoplescampaign.org, there's ways that you can donate online there. There's lots of ways we can get you involved. We're also looking for people to do phone banking, texting, canvassing. So, but even if you're not mobile for whatever reason and you're at home, but you're like, I am so motivated, please, there's lots of ways that you can get involved. And if you're like, who is this Bishop Barber person? Who is this Poor People's Campaign? Who is this Liz Thayer Harris? Just Google. Just go to YouTube and Google some of the videos. You know, Yara Allen, Google her. And you will see so much information, so many sermons. There's TED Talks, all of it. We just really want you to be inspired. Because what happened was, if I could just give a little bit of a history, if that's okay with you, Chris.
Go ahead.
That on December 4th, 1967, Dr. King and his cohorts, they launched the Poor People's Campaign. And 5 months later, to the day, he was murdered. And when he was murdered, in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968, the campaign pretty much kind of died with him. It didn't really get moving. And why was he in Memphis, Tennessee? He was there for the sanitation strike. He was there for the garbage workers. He was there for the lowest of the low. He was there for the Poor People's Campaign. A month later, in May of 1968, there was supposed to be a huge march in Washington. It never happened. Mm-hmm. Well, then, on December 4th, 2017, the campaign was officially relaunched in Washington, D.C., with a press conference. And then, in the spring of 2018, we did our 40 days of direct action, where every Monday for 6 weeks across the United States, at the capitals of each state, people were doing direct action and getting arrested to take a stand that not enough was being done to address the issues around the poor and low-income people in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I just want to let you know, on that day, in June of 2018, the march did happen, and we had 20,000 people show up. This time, we want to make it even bigger, and we want 100,000 people to show up in Washington, D.C. on June 18th. And you want to know why it's going to happen, Chris? Because all your listeners are going to go. They're going to get there somehow, or maybe they can help financially support to get someone there.
Yeah.
But this is important work, what we're doing.
It is, and I really appreciate you preaching it to us, because without that spirit, we won't go. We've been shut up in COVID, and we have been, you know, divided and put down a lot. So I really appreciate your enthusiasm, and I hope people will step up, because this is the time. This has to happen now. We need to redirect these monies that are going to go into militarism and the pockets of the rich. If we don't, you know, we've got to step up for ourselves. So it's really important. You know,
right.
I really appreciate you, Pamela Anderson, for your work. And I just wanted to end. We have like 2 minutes left. And I wanted to just bring to your attention this tweet that Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign did on the 27th of February. He said, "We stand with the people of Russia who immediately took to the streets at great personal risk to nonviolently protest this war. We stand with the people of Ukraine who have been resisting the drive to war and nuclear annihilation." So how does the Poor People's Campaign frame the war on Ukraine, what's happening to the people there, and what can we learn from nonviolent resistance within Ukraine?
So one of the things that that Bishop Barber and Liz Taylor Harris are talking about is that they're making also the connection with Ukraine with the Edmund Pettus Bridge of today, and where they're saying where everyone could come together in the open and defeat the autocracy's power with the body, with their bodies and their courage to build a worldwide moral stance. So, what if we all took a stand and we said no to war? One of the things that Bishop Barber said, indeed, the entire world must stand against this war and any war and the danger that it poses to escalate into nuclear violence and the annihilation of existence. As Dr. King once said, our choice in the face of nuclear war is not between violence and nonviolence, but rather between nonviolence and non-existence. So we must choose peace, love, justice, and life. So really, what we need to do is we need to take a stand, because these are very serious times. And if we don't do anything, then we just become compliant with what is happening. And we just need to say enough's enough.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your leadership in all of this, Dr. Pamela Anderson, with the Poor People's Campaign. I'm going to repeat this again, because I think if our listeners are enthused, they should write to you right now before they get distracted. So it's mobilizecalifornia@gmail.com and the Poor People's www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. And and let's get moving on this. Thank you so much for your leadership. We really appreciate you.
Thank you. And do you mind if I just share just one more thing really quickly before
sure.
I go?
Go ahead.
One of the things that happened last August, Bishop Barber called me, and I'd shared with him what someone had said to me. They said, do you really have to get arrested when you go to Washington, D.C., when you're doing direct action? No embarrassing pictures. And I said to Bishop Barber, what kind of minister does she think I am? And he said, what kind of Jesus does she follow? And I said, yes. Sometimes we need to speak up and show up. And sometimes I feel like as people of faith, maybe we are too polite. And there comes a time when we need to say, no, we're showing up. And when something's wrong, we just need to be there and be present. So I'm hoping that we can all be there and show up and follow the Jesus or the whatever faith journey you are on that really aligns with taking a stand so that everyone has a right to live.
That's right. And let me get another person from the Poor People's Campaign on in May so we can keep pressing this forward and help.
Yay.
You can refer me. Thank you so much for your time and for your ministry, your work in the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. All right, folks, so much on the Poor People's Campaign. I hope we can be directed and move forward with this. It's important. And a couple of things I just wanted to mention. A big shout out to Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. I'm very, very delighted for your Supreme Court nomination, and that's for Women's History Month. I just wanted a shout out for that. And also for the birthday of Lynn Jensen, who turned 90 this week. He has been a great peacemaker in our community for all the years that he's lived here. So that. And then don't forget the Peace Vigil this Saturday, 12:30 to 1:30 at the corner of 3rd and Main. There is a global action to support the people of Ukraine, say no to NATO and no to Putin's invasion. And let's see, also coming up is the anniversary of the murder of Desmond Phillips. That's on the 17th. So I hope that you will go to the Justice for Desmond Facebook page and learn more about that. I'd like to thank our underwriters for making this show possible. We couldn't do it without you. And I'd like to thank Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. And by Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. We are also supported by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And I'd like to also thank the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O'Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O'Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. The telephone number for Michael O'Hayes is 530-892-8916, or you can email him at norcalbankruptcy@gmail.com. It's coming up on 12 o'clock. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. They are just mine and my guests. And we're going to move forward with another song, another guest, always always a full program here on the Peace and Justice program with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1. I hope you will stay tuned also afterwards for Playing Dead and support support every single show that is on our radio station here at KZFR. So this should be Emma's Revolution. Here we go.
Soldiers and thought I saw me. Looked at the children and saw my own face. I saw myself dying all over the place. Saw myself hiding and shaking with fear, desperately wondering how I got here. From the seat on my bus to my mother's front door, to my shock I had come home right into a war. So many years and we're back here again. Wasn't anyone listening then? Are we listening now? Have we joined the debate? Our Gulf of Tonkin, our Watergate, our 9/11, our own demise. No more silence and the young man whose number was up. I could see the girl pleading and shaking a cup. Her mother beside her missing a leg. A field, a landmine, a reason to beg. A reason to cower, a reason to fight. A reason to question who's wrong and who's right. To raise up a rifle and sharply take aim. Find myself caught in the midst of a game. So many years and we're back here again. Wasn't anyone listening then?
All right, that song isn't actually what I meant to play. It's Emma's Revolution, but it does fit because a war never seems to have any reason to it, if you've noticed. And this one is no different than that. And they are all so deadly and need to be prevented. So speaking of prevention, I have on the line with me Malachy McBride. He is the executive director for the National Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund Bill. Malachy McBride has a long history as an activist organizer on a variety of peace and justice issues, including opposing the war and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, the abolition of torture, opposing U.S. Patriot Act, the U.S. Military Commissions Act, the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and he also has been a longtime supporter of the struggle of the Palestinian people, calling for an end to the Israeli occupation. He's a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends, belonging to Friends Meeting of Washington in Washington, D.C., where he serves as clerk of the Peace and Social Concerns Committee, in addition to serving on the Peace and Social Concerns Committee of Baltimore yearly meeting. He's also on the board of directors of the William Penn House in Washington, D.C. And again, back to why I'm calling him today, he is the director of the National Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund Bill. We want to talk about that. The Peace Tax Fund Bill would amend the Internal Revenue Code to permit taxpayers conscientiously opposed to the participating in war to have their income, estate, or gift tax payments spent for non-military purposes only. Malachy, welcome to the Peace and Justice Show. Can you tell us about the Religious Freedom Peace Tax Fund Bill and why it is so important to those who cannot in good conscience pay for war?
Well, hello, and thank you for having me on your program today. Sure. So the National Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund, which has promoted and lobbied for the Peace Tax Fund Bill, has been around. This is the 50th year the bill has been in Congress. It has been introduced almost every year. Recently, it was reintroduced in the summer of last year, 2021, by Representative Jim McGovern of Western Massachusetts. And prior to that, for a couple of decades, it was introduced every year, every congressional session, by the late John Lewis of Georgia. And it was originally introduced, as I said, 50 years ago, by Representative Ron Dellums of the Bay Area there in California. The bill would help the civil rights, the constitutional First Amendment rights of people who are morally and ethically opposed to participating in war, especially through their income tax payment and other financial payments to the government. People who are concerned about this bill and this issue believe that their income taxes are conscripted. So we see conscientious objection not just as an issue for, you know, mostly young people who are drafted to go to war, but the average person who works and has to pay taxes will have a moral objection to war, and every year they pay their income taxes, they find themselves in a deeply morally conflicted place where they know a huge percentage of their income tax money goes to pay for war, pay for the old wars, and pay for future wars. I believe it was your previous guest in the previous segment who gave the percentage at 59%. The amount of money is debatable. Some people would say it's as low as 30-some percent. Other people put it over 50%. But the main point is that the First Amendment rights of conscientious objectors to war are not being fulfilled in present-day America.
You know, I was there in 1990, right after Iraq invaded Kuwait, and in those days, some of the supporters of the bill, some of the sponsors of the bill were Republicans, Mark Hatfield and Wayne Morse, so these are really different times. But since this is Women's History Month, I wanted to go back to the person who was leading the campaign at that time was Marion Franz, and I got to meet her, and I got to stay at your William Penn house in Washington when we were doing our lobbying, and so it's like a little more of the history of this amazing effort to give. First, it was historic peace churches and people who were, you know, who have go so far back with conscience and unwillingness to work or pay for war, and then it became other people too, like myself, who do not have a church affiliation. But can you tell us about Marion Franz and about her work and her role in the national campaign for a peace tax fund bill?
Right. So Marion Franz was, I guess you could say, an iconic figure in our movement for the rights of conscientious objectors and a champion of the mission of the National Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund. She preceded me as the director 10 years before I came on board. Unfortunately, I didn't have the luck of meeting her, but her work with the National Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund has cast a long shadow, and it is difficult to go through any week or month of the year without hearing from somebody who knew her and appreciated her work. She was the director for about 24 years of the work of our organization, and she was very, very well respected. You know, for example, John Lewis of Georgia, who was our sponsor for many years, said that that she was a tireless voice for religious freedom and the rights of people of conscience. And he said that her energy and her persistence in advocating for the Religious Freedom Peace Tax Fund Act was a reflection of her deep commitment to our democracy and the cause of peace. So she was very dedicated to our mission. She was someone who was born into one of the historic peace churches. She was a lifelong Mennonite. She went to religious schools and worked on this issue after she moved to Washington in the late 1960s. She was also a person who was involved in the civil rights movement. So she comes from that era of people who were deeply moved by their conscience to participate in issues like the civil rights movement and also the anti-war movement.
You know, I'm trying to think of our listeners and trying to think of questions that they would need answered. And I think probably many have never considered war tax resistance and really don't understand that call to conscience that makes it so that you can't have these little proxy soldiers that live in your wallet out there fighting wars for you. Can you talk some about conscientious objection in regards to, you know, war in terms of a soldier picking up a gun, but also our war and the taxes that we pay that go for these wars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. And so just one of the misunderstandings or misconceptions about my organization and the bill we have, because of its name, which is sort of a historic moniker that has been used, which is the Religious Freedom Peace Tax Fund Act, this bill and what we are working on with regard to this aspect of conscientious objection is not just for religious people. It is for people who have deeply held moral and ethical beliefs about their non-participation in war in all of its different forms. So someone does not have to belong to any religion or any church. There are plenty of atheists and humanists who are conscientious objectors. But one of the things I've found when I talk to people across the United States, especially people who are themselves involved in peace issues, I always get a question from someone who is an activist and involved in things. They always say, "But this is great work you're doing, but am I a conscientious objector?" So I think we have this stereotype, this image of a conscientious objector being a person who's trying to avoid military service or get out of the military after they've had some type of personal conversion. But really, conscientious objection is for anyone who is opposed to war, regardless of their sex or sexuality or their belief in any type of higher being. It's for the average person, the regular person who has a job, who finds themselves in a moral and ethical bind when it comes to tax day, when they have to pay the government, and they know that this huge percentage of their money is going to go to pay for war and future wars and so forth.
Yeah, this has been a long haul for people who are opposed to war, because we've had so many of them, and now we're looking at something that could be so catastrophic and could be so destructive to the entire planet. It's a very, very difficult view that we have from here. But staying the course, I think, is important. And perhaps you need to update us about the status of this bill, because we don't want to make it sound like this bill is about to be passed and that people could, you know, could take advantage of it right away. It's been a long haul. Tell us where we are.
Well, I came on board as the director the same month that the recent former president took office. So for 4 years of my tenure in Washington, D.C., we had to deal with all of what that administration was about. So as you know, on Capitol Hill, And even to this present day, there is a lot of strife and conflict. And you referenced earlier the Republicans who had supported our bill many years ago. And the times have changed. There really is this partisan, block in Congress for many things, not just what our bill would be about, but, you know, we see that the Congress couldn't even pass the voting rights legislation recently. But our bill was introduced, as I said before, last year by Representative Jim McGovern. In the coming weeks and months of this year, we're hoping to generate our grassroots supporters and urge them to contact their members of the House of Representatives to become a co-sponsor of the bill. Right now, there are no co-sponsors. It's just the sponsorship of Representative Jim McGovern. So if people go to our website, peacetaxfund.org, you can get information about how you can plug in. There is a petition online that is one of our important tools to work with people in congressional districts across the United States. I think many members of Congress could very easily sign on to this. I know that there are people across the country who live in districts where there are members who would not be receptive to this piece of legislation. But in getting co-sponsors, what we're also doing is highlighting this issue of conscientious objection. We don't know how many people across the country would fall into this category. Maybe it's a minority, I don't know, but there is no one source that is pulling all of us together who are conscientious objectors to war. And I think this bill could be a way to rally around this First Amendment constitutional issue.
We're speaking to Malachi McBride. He is the National Campaign for Peace Tax Fund Bill director. And one of the things that I don't think we've mentioned is that people who, if the bill were enacted, people would still pay their full share of taxes. This is not anything to do with tax evasion. Is that correct?
That is correct. What the bill would do is have the Secretary of the Treasury, who oversees the IRS, a separate fund or account in the U.S. Treasury would be set up so that whatever that percentage is, and that is, you know, obviously going to be debatable, that percentage that goes to paying for war and other military expenditures would go into this separate fund, and it could only be used for non-military purposes. And, you know, what that would look like as far as, you know, how it would look on a tax form, I don't know. Those are the details that would have to be worked out. But yes, you are correct. People would still be able to pay 100% of the taxes, but that percentage that goes for military purposes would be funneled into a separate account. So the individual who is a CO, a conscientious objector, would in good conscience be able to pay their income taxes in full. As it stands now, there are people across the United States who are called war tax resistors. And these people either don't pay any income tax or they choose a percentage that they are going to withhold from the government as a form of protest to protect their consciences. Then there are other people who choose to live below the taxable income, and they avoid this matter by living under the taxable income, which is actually almost poverty, you know. And then there is the much larger group of people who are the people who pay their taxes in full every year, and they feel morally conflicted. They feel terrible because they know their money is being spent to pay for all of the wars and all of the other military issues that they are opposed to.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that must be something that people are facing right now. I'd also like to mention another organization. It's called the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. You can use the initials NWTRCC.org, and they have information about how to become a war tax resister, if that is on your bucket list, which it was on mine in 1980, and I have not filed since. So I also haven't done a good job with keeping up on the Peace Tax Fund bill. And I went to your website and was really impressed about a lot of the pamphlets and things there. You mentioned your website already, Malachi McBride, but what else can people find there in order to kind of flesh out their information about the Peace Tax Fund bill?
Sure. I consider our website to always be a work in progress. So what we have attempted to do with our website is to show that this is a constitutional issue. This is a First Amendment issue. This is a civil rights issue because it is a constitutional issue. But what we've also tried to do is show that the world of conscientious objection is much bigger than what goes on in the United States, and that large bodies such as the United Nations or governmental networks or like the European Union, they have made statements about conscientious objection too. And there are people all across the world who work on issues of conscientious objection. You know, obviously, the primary focus in many places is that it is about people who are conscripted into the military and have to perform military service. But really, as I said before, the issue of conscientious objection is an issue for everyone who is opposed to war. And, you know, in the context of my work, it is focused on the fact that our income tax money is conscripted. And because of that, we still end up participating in war. And, you know, as a lot of us who've been around for some time know, you know, I refer to it as the war machine. You know, it's not just the Pentagon. It's the Department of Energy. It's the State Department, you know, giving out foreign military aid and so forth. But we know that in, like, practically every congressional district across the United States, there is at least one war contractor. And, you know, if you talk to members of Congress, including members who would be receptive to the Peace Tax Fund bill, they always come back to, oh, well, you know, it brings jobs into the district, you know, and that always seems to be, you know, the primary concern. But we see how big a leviathan this war machine is. It's everywhere. And the wars of the United States are being waged in plain sight. You know, we have these proxy wars with Yemen. We have the use of drones in different parts of the world, you know, whether it's, Iraq, Afghanistan, but also in various African countries. You know, the military footprint of the United States is huge.
You know, I have one more minute with you, and I praise you for your work, and I just, I know I'm not giving enough time, but do you want to say something about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how nonviolent advocates are responding and can respond? Then thank you.
Yeah, sure. Well, I am really disturbed by what Russia did by invading another country. It was wrong for Russia to invade the Ukraine, just as it was wrong for the United States to wage a war based on lies in which we went into Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, you know, I am hoping for and advocating for a diplomatic solution. The United States does not have any military alliance with the Ukraine. It's not in NATO, and it is also not in the European Union. And so we're in a very difficult situation in which the Russians have gone in, and the United States and NATO seem to be leading the charge for whatever happens next. And what happened last night with regard to the nuclear plant is really deeply concerning. I mean, after all, Russia is a nuclear power also, and we have to find a way to, take the pressure off and figure out a way to move forward in which military force is not used. And I'm hopeful. I know across the country, people will be gathering this Saturday. I live in Baltimore, and I know that there's groups that are organizing a vigil in the hopes that, nonviolent actions can be taken by governments to reduce this conflict.
Thank you, Malachi McBride. Thank you for everything that you're doing for peace, and appreciate you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having us, and people can find out more at peacetaxfund.org. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Peace. Thank you.
Okay, some more sobering information and important, and I appreciate him very much. We're going to move on to our third guest here in a second. I wanted to say again that we will be at the Peace Vigil, been at the Peace Vigil since 1960, so there's nothing new there, but this time we want to get those corners filled. We want people to be able to rally and march and to stand up against war, and not just in Ukraine, but also where there's a very intense situation going on now to get a War Powers Act passed for Yemen and to get reparations for, not reparations, but to free up the money of Afghanistan that's been held by the United States government, which does not own this money. People are starving in Afghanistan. So there's a lot of issues. However, I imagine that you'll want to come out about Ukraine and to give solidarity with Ukraine. And so please join us 12:30 to 1:30, corner 3rd and Main. And also I would refer you to another group I don't have time to talk about, but at cc4jchico.org, Concerned Citizens for Justice, has a statement about the officer-involved shooting deaths in Chico Butte County and calling for independent investigations from our Attorney General Rob Bonta into policing here in Chico and throughout Butte County with our DA. So I hope that you will check that out. I'm going to go on to a song by... Mara Levine from her album called Facets of Folk. Here you go.
I once asked the farmer as he toiled in the row to tell me his secret for making things grow. I'll always remember that look in his eye as he studied God's acre and gave his reply. You reap what you sow, so you'd better plan wisely, that the harvest may yield you a bounty of good. You get what you give, so give completely. All your deeds will return as they should. I once asked the baker as he leavened his bread why he went to such measure to make it the best. Without hesitation, without missing a beat, he put that bread in the oven and said these words to me.
You reap what you sow. There we go. And so this is the Peace and Justice Program. Please stay tuned for Playing Dead at 1 o'clock. I have Brian Terrell or Terrell? How do you say your last name, Brian?
Terrell. Terrell.
Okay. I finally got it. Okay. Brian Terrell is an Iowa-based peace activist and outreach coordinator for the Nevada Desert Experience. He is one of the foremost activists that I turn to for guidance when I'm listening in to the voice of my own conscience. I also have to resonate with other people. I have to know how other people are thinking. And Brian is one of the people formerly with Witness for Peace. Voices
for Creative Nonviolence.
For Creative Nonviolence, I'm sorry. And you go way back. I know that you go back to your earliest days when you were 19 years old and you moved into a Catholic worker house. You were with Dorothy Day there in 1975, and at that time she was 78 years old, and you lived in that house for 4 years until the year before her passing. And being as this is Women's History Month, I wanted to first talk about Dorothy Day just briefly, about her beliefs and associations. And I know she's being very idealized now, which really wasn't her form of pacifism. But can you tell us a little bit about why she is somebody that we should know about on Women's History Month?
Oh, well, yeah, she was the founder of the Catholic Worker with Peter Morin in 1933. And actually, one of the first voices for peace, even during World War II, and immediately after Pearl Harbor, she wrote one of the most touching pieces. If you look for it online from the Catholic Worker, 1945, about Hiroshima and how she even said that. Living in New York City, that what she'd read in the papers, that because of the people who were vaporized in Hiroshima, so many thousands of miles away, that she was conscious of breathing in the ashes of these brothers and sisters who were incinerated. There's a big push for her canonization for the Catholic Church to name her a saint, which I am just ambivalent about mostly, but I'm concerned, as you said, the idea of idealizing her and making her her pacifism, her passion for social justice, into something, as one Catholic bishop said, that it's always should be on the margins, and that she should be remembered as a woman who was once promiscuous but then repented of her sins. So those are the most important things. But these last days, it's even clearer that we're on the verge of destruction of every living being on this planet. And learning to love one another and learning voluntary poverty of taking with less, living with less, of meeting challenges nonviolently. This is not any kind of airy-fairy, Neverland kind of thing. Like one bishop said, this is, that Dorothy's pacifism shows us what heaven will be like when there is no killing, just as celibacy among priests and nuns show us what it'll be like when there's no sex in heaven. There'll be no guns in heaven either. So we have to have celibates and pacifists to give us a foretaste of heaven. And that's BS. This is more than ever. This is total pragmatism. It's taking the hard, cold, realistic look at the world and saying we can't keep doing what we're doing. We cannot keep going the direction we're going, and survive. So I think her message is so important, and it's ironic and sad to me that as the church is pushing her name and her as a figurehead, the main thing she had to tell us, gets left behind sometimes.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. So you are somebody who has followed through that pragmatism, that that understanding. You are living it now, and I wanted to just let our listeners know a couple of things that you've been doing recently. On February 18th, you were found guilty and given a suspended sentence for an action that you took in on Memorial Day when you were arrested for trespass. Very briefly, can you tell us about why you trespassed and a little bit about the legal system, but it has to be brief.
Yeah, well, it's what it goes on to what's happening today. In Kansas City, and I live about 120 miles from there in Iowa, there's a factory it's owned by the Department of Energy Nuclear National Security Agency, operated by Honeywell, that is making the non-nuclear components of the new nuclear missiles and bombs that are in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's a program Obama started, at more than $1 trillion in these next years to modernize all of our new nuclear weapons and make them more easily deployable and more flexible, which means more easy to use, which of course is frightening to people in other parts of the world. So there's a group, Peaceworks KC in Kansas City that I work with often, that every year has a Memorial Day service at this plant. And remembering the people who have been who have already died in the making of nuclear weapons, and those who remembering even before they're dead, the future victims, God forbid, of this. So yeah, I was arrested for trespass, and finally got to trial with four friends, three friends on the 18th, and we were found guilty, and the judge. A young black man, and it shows my age when I see judges and I think they look like kids, was a very good man, and it was a very touching event. And he told us we should, that he commended us for obeying a higher law, but said that we did break the law. And he said, we have a year's probation and 18 and a 6-month suspended sentence. But he said, we're not going to spend any of that time in jail. But I felt very sad for him because he found us guilty, not because we broke the law, because we didn't. The law in Missouri for trespass is either you knowingly enter into the property or stay on the property of another for an unlawful purpose. And we knew we were there for a lawful purpose. And the Kansas City prosecutor offered no evidence to the contrary, but we offered evidence that we did know that it was illegal, that what we were doing was legal, that a crime is being committed in Kansas City, but it's not by the protesters. The crime is being committed by the operators of that plant, and it's a crime against humanity, and it's a crime against local law, international law, and the higher law, not to mention the higher law that the judge alluded to. And, I feel for Judge Bland, but I really think he was trying to have it both ways. And I'm glad I'm not in jail at talking to you now. But I think we need to take risks, and people like Judge Bland need to take risks. Right. And if he had followed the law, he'd be taking a risk. Because there's the higher law in this country, unfortunately, beyond anything that's written down, and it's a law that we're not even allowed to mention, says that the production of weapons of mass destruction will march forward without any interruption, and laws be damned, the United Nations Charter be damned, U.S. Constitution be damned, human decency be damned. We're going to make those goddamn weapons no matter what.
Right. You know, you use your own body, your own life as kind of a crucible of this. And I know you're arrested again in the Netherlands at Vogel Air Force Base when you dug a hole with some other people to go under the fence with European activists there. And can you tell us a little bit about that action and about your concerns about this NATO summit?
Well, I think a lot of people are surprised by why anybody would be against NATO. It's just it's a mutual defense, mutual aid society. People get together to defend themselves, but say what's the problem with Ukraine as a sovereign nation deciding it wants to join? But it's not. It's a criminal gang. It's a suicide murder pact because this is all tied in with nuclear weapons. And if the United States decides that it's time to end the human experiment and kill everyone, every NATO nation is going to participate. And this is part of it. And I've been arrested. I'm on probation in Missouri, and I'm wanted in Wisconsin, and I'm facing a 30-day sentence in Germany, and I'm facing more criminal charges that haven't come up yet in Netherlands. But in these places, this base is one where it's a Dutch military base, and there is a U.S. Air Force squadron there that has control over 20 B-61 bombs, nuclear bombs. The B-6-112 is being produced right now in Kansas City, and that's part of my reason for going there. A new nuclear bomb that's going to be the ones they have now just drop out of the airplane, but these are ones that are going to be able to be steered. They can guide them to their targets. It's a very scary development. Against Dutch law, against U.S. law. The Dutch Parliament was not informed. They found out officially that this was going on just a couple of years ago by accident, by somebody leaked some papers. But everybody knew that they were there. And they practice all the time. We were there for while I was in Europe. NATO was going through an exercise called Steadfast Noon. Which they were, practicing putting nuclear bombs on Dutch and German and Italian and Turkish bombers, Belgian bombers, and taking them to up to practicing what it would be to deliver these to Russia. So and for Ukraine to join NATO is joining this club of people, of nations that get together and practice bombing Russia. So of course that was something that's a threat to peace. It's not something protecting it.
Yeah, you just wrote an article that I'd like you to elaborate on, because your views are so different than so many people's, and it's really important for people to know this history. It is titled, "Let Them Kill As Many As Possible, The United States Policy Toward Russia and Its Neighbors." Can you describe some of that history?
Yeah, well, I'm reading a book about right now, Learning from the Germans, which is talking about how Germany has dealt with its past with World War II and the Holocaust, and how in the United States, especially in the South, but all of us, dealing with the history, our history of slavery, especially, and also of robbing the land from the native people, and how Germans are dealing with how we are too. And I found this quote from Harry Truman when he was Senator of Missouri, April of 1941. It was 4 years before he was president, 8 months before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. entered World War II. At that time, Germany invaded the Soviet Union. And from the floor of the Senate, he said this: "If we see Germany as winning the war, we ought to help Russia. And that if Russia's winning, we ought to help Germany. And that way, let them kill as many as possible." And at the time, he was praised for that. And when he died in 1972, I found his obituary in the New York Times, and they cited the statement as establishing, quote, his reputation for decisiveness and courage. Mm. It's a basic attitude, the Times said, that prepared him to adopt from the start of his presidency a firm policy. And so that enabled him to order the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with no qualms.
It's horrible.
And that really has been, and this is the founder, the man credited with founding the NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the CIA. And we've seen this through history from, you know, Central America, you know, in Vietnam, Afghanistan, especially because that was a NATO operation, especially, you know, Brzezinski, who was, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor after the Soviet, you know, 1998, he was interviewed and he was saying after the Soviet Union fell, he was saying that it wasn't Reagan who did it, it was Carter, because Carter had secretly been funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan for months before the Soviets invaded, and admitted that this was bragging. You know, he said, "We did this. We lured the Soviets into the trap." When when the day the Soviets officially crossed the border, I'm quoting from him. Brzezinski recalled, "I wrote to President Carter essentially, we have the opportunity of giving to the USSR its Vietnam War." And indeed, for almost 10 years, Moscow had to carry on a war that was unsustainable for the regime, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and finally the breakup of the Soviet Empire. So it helped bring down the Soviets, but what did it do to Afghanistan? Of course, during those years, Carter and then after that Reagan were saying, we're helping freedom fighters. We're helping the Afghan people gain their independence. But really, it was a very cynical exploitation. Before all this, the Taliban didn't exist, before the United States invaded and so liberated the people of Iraq from Saddam Hussein. ISIS didn't exist. We're making the world much less stable.
Right.
And it's been said many times that after NATO was supposedly set up to defend the West from Soviet aggression, the Soviets were gone in the early 90s. And it said that the only reason that NATO exists anymore is to deal with the instability that the existence of NATO necessarily causes. And I really believe that's true.
You know, I do want to ask you about Afghanistan because you are so so grounded there. You were a peace activist in Afghanistan. You went there 7 times during the war between 2010 and 2019, and worked a lot with people. You have many friends there. I'd like your response to the U.S. freezing of Afghanistan's financial assets and giving half to 9/11 victims, and your overall take on the U.S. withdrawal.
Well, it's a tragedy of the invasion of Ukraine, which is I think there's an awful lot of racism involved in how the nuclear threat is not there with these other wars, with the war that we're engaged, you know, we're killing people by proxy in Yemen, in Gaza, in Afghanistan. And there are millions and millions of refugees in the world that are not getting the welcome that the Ukrainian refugees certainly do deserve. I'm not saying that. And until the world was beginning to pay some attention to what's going on in Afghanistan when this invasion happened, and of course in our media, the sufferings of white people always get more attention than the sufferings of people of color. And the sufferings caused by other people are always get more light than the sufferings caused by the U.S. and its allies and our policies. But yeah, after the war stopped in Afghanistan, and the Taliban took over, but the Taliban didn't exist before the United States got involved in Afghanistan, and it was defeated in 2001 or 2002, it didn't need to come back except for the exploitation and cruelty of the American, of the U.S. and NATO occupation of that country. And that's the government that the Afghans are left with. And the war stopped. Our soldiers are not there, but we are still in what President Biden calls over the horizon fighting in Afghanistan, which means bombers and drones. Well, what happened not that many weeks ago is President Biden, in order to keep the Afghan government now, which is the Taliban, from having access to funds, the frozen assets of in American banks, the government, previous government, put a lot of money. I think there's more than $9 billion in American banks. Half of it would be go to aid in Afghanistan, which is going to be not administered by the United Nations or by Afghanistan, but by the United States that had really been the perpetrator of the crime to begin with. But half of that money is going to go to the victims of 9/11. The Americans who suffered in the attacks of 9/11 and their survivors, and it's like they need to be cared for. There should be their suffering. I don't want to diminish it at all, but Saudi Arabia is much more responsible. The Saudis in Germany, who in Hamburg, Germany, thought if you buy the official narrative, it was Saudis in Germany who came up with the plan. No Afghan had anything to do with 9/11. It's unclear whether any Afghan knew about it ahead of time, was involved in any kind of way. And besides this, it was more than 20 years ago, but the median age in Afghanistan is a few months over 18 years old. And so the majority of Afghans, the people who are really suffering, the banks are frozen, teachers aren't getting paid, factory workers aren't getting paid. They don't have money. The government doesn't have money to buy food from outside the country. The U.S. brags that it's given like $800 million in aid so far, but they spent $300 million a day for the war. And so $800 million after 6 months is pretty paltry for a country of so many millions of people that are most of them on the a large number on the brink of starvation. But these were children. The majority were not born yet. The vast majority of those who were born were children when this happened. And they're being punished for a crime that they didn't commit. And yeah. It's horrendous. And I think what you said, I have a different view of what's happening in Ukraine than other people, and I think it's a view. There are not many people in the United States who are really paying attention until something like this happens. And if it just dawns on you for the first time, Afghanistan or the Ukraine is being invaded by Russia, and of course that's a horror, and of course that's a crime. But if you haven't heard about the other crimes, if you haven't, if you haven't known people and talked to people who have been through these horrific things, you see it in one way. But if you see it in the context, the sins and crimes of other people of our own do not excuse other people's, and there's nothing that we've done that excuses what Putin has done. But things happen for a reason. and stating the reason that something happens is not to excuse it. It's just the kind of understanding that we have to have, that we need to have. Again, I was just saying about Dorothy Day, and one of the things that she's often quoted saying, the one solution is love. And that's what it comes down to, the hard pragmatic fact, hard cold fact, is the one solution is love. And if we can't start loving each other and caring about the people of Afghanistan as much as we care about the people of Ukraine, and care about the people of Ukraine as much as we care about our own elders and our own children, we can't have. If we have a future on this planet, it will not be a very pleasant one for anyone.
I want to thank you for being my guest today. You answered the last question I had about, you know, what should peace activists be doing during this time. And I agree with you. We have to just keep our eyes open to everything, wherever the injustice is occurring. Mm. Thank you so much, Brian Terrell, for all of your peace work. And stay in good trouble. Please.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
All right, bye.
Bye.
All right, so that wraps up another edition of the Peace and Justice program. We'll be back with you next Friday at 11:30, and thank you to my guests who just amaze me so much. I'm so grateful to get to do these interviews here at KZFR, your community radio station. And I want to go out thanking one of our underwriters, or two of them actually. I'd like to thank the Chico News and Review, your local news, commentary, and entertainment source. The March issue hits the stands on Thursday the 10th with the rebirth of the Environmental Coalition of Butte County, an interview with musician Melissa Etheridge, and more. The Chico News and Review is available at hundreds of locations throughout Butte County and online at chiconewsreview.com. And by Baird Roofing Company, for a hole in your roof or a whole new roof. Baird Roofing Company has been serving Butte County for more than 30 years. Whether it's an existing structure or new construction, Baird Roofing has got you covered. More information at BairdRoofingCo.com and 342-1631. So stay tuned for the community calendar and then Playing Dead. Peace to all of you. Come on out and join us to make more peace out on the corners and the streets. Here we go.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Tuvo Importa Photo Voice Project exhibition will open Saturday, March 5th at the Valine L. Smith Museum of Amsterdam.